Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough. This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me, I've waited long enough.
As I gaze upon the beautiful abyss of outer space, I can't help but reminisce on how we held on to our faith. Gold is how we stayed till the day that time would say that Toonami's back, bitches. Pardon my francais. Now every week the absolution blasts off while the masses watch as an old familiar mascot by the name of Tom takes a seat and kicks the broadcast off, making major moves like a triple cut backdrop. I still remember watching that Beyond doing damage and thinking, damn, is Goku ever gonna reach Namek? Obviously I got a lot of love for the classics. The speed at which I used to run home to watch was the fastest. Absolution moving, flying through the galaxy. Toonami's back, the slap in the face to those who doubted it. Remain Toonami faithful till the day that I am gray and old, and like a Super Saiyan's glow, I will always stay gold.
This is Nerdcore Absolution. Come to peace with your inner nerd, and after you can stay gold like T.O.M. Chilling out the galaxy and we know him. Putting tunes up that'll keep you up. Glued to the screen like you do too much. The galaxy is ours, the sun and the stars. Toonami's on and chilling hard.
Watching closely from a perch among the stars, as viewers await the moment when the spirit bomb can charge. Hito Yui self-detonates.
Hey there, my Tom generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, Tom, your host, and this is episode 130 of The Prerogative. And this time out, well, we've finished February. We've finished looking at an entire month where we look at romance of all types. But now we start a month that is one of my favorite of the year. And it's a month that of everything I've done in this podcast, it's one month I've not missed. I'm, of course, talking about Disney Month. The one month that I dedicate to reviewing everything Walt Disney. Because I am a Disney fanatic. And yes, this is an addiction, and yes, I need help, but I'm never going to get it. Because I am addicted to Disney. Because, quite frankly, Walt Disney and the Walt Disney Company have created some of the most wonderful animated features, along with animated cartoons, out there. And this year, we're going to cover a film I've been wanting to cover for the longest time. We're going all the way back to the beginning, to where it all began as far as animated feature-length films. We're going all the way back to 1937. Or 1938, depending on whether you consider it a nationwide release to be the official release date or its premiere. Its premiere was on December 21st, 1937. Nationwide, it premiered on February 4th, 1938, but that's not the point. The point is, of course, I am talking about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. A film that is not just considered, pretty much is the grandfather and godfather of all feature-length animation. It was the first full-length, self-animated feature film. It was called Walt Disney's Folly and turned out to be his greatest triumph when everybody said it couldn't be done. It launched Walt Disney Company. It's the reason, not just for animated film, but the entire company was launched off of Snow White and Seven Dwarfs. Its success is paramount to why, whether it be animated films, Walt Disney Company existing, tons of other things, it's paramount to its success. We are talking about a film that is part of the National Registry of the United States Library of Congress because of its historical importance. And yet, after 80, almost 90 years. In fact, I think it's been about 80 years, excuse me. It'll be 90 years, like, in 2020s, but Yeah. In its 80 years of existence. Or almost 80 years. Almost 80, in fact. Because 1937 will be... Yeah, 2017 will be the 80th anniversary. So, 79. Yeah, I had to do the math there. Math caught up to me. But in 79 years of existence, it's still one of the most important films out there. The question we are going to devise today is, has Father Time caught up to this film? Or will this film forever remain timeless? I know a lot of people saying, isn't that obvious? But you never know. And again, it's all my prerogative. So today on Tom's Prerogative, we cover Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Now, like I said, this is a historically important film. Again, not just to American animation, to Japanese animation. There are so many Japanese animators. From Tetsuo and Ogawa and all the greats who have made mention of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs being a major influence on them. You know, it's one of those funny things in all the years back when I started developing my idea of anime being maybe born in America. What film could it possibly be? Part of it was always looking at those interviews, and it would always be that they would say Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and then they would say, and other Disney films. And it was that idea of, well, what are the other Disney films that ultimately led me to figuring out that it was Sleeping Beauty, as far as Sleeping Beauty's style. But the reason Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs has been so influential is its story. Which may seem strange because it's a very simple story and in a way very simply done. But at the same point in time, that story structure, the idea of an animated film as far as animation going for 90 minutes and telling a complete story was something new and refreshing and very influential at the time. It may be hard for us to see it that way 79 years later. But back in the day, that was hugely influential. You know, in fact, there were, you know, feature-length films themselves weren't like old things at the time. Film was still a new thing. Hollywood was still new. I mean, it was still the time of the Hollywood system. They were only starting to get into color and sound, you know. It was only 10 years prior that Walt Disney released Steamboat Willie, which was a black and white cartoon, but was the first cartoon to have sound. And about 5 years after that, they had color. So sound had only been a part of film for about 10 years, give or take. And I'm talking regarding animated feature films, or animated features for that matter, and cartoons as such. And actual color in the animation, half that. So Walt Disney was really writing the book as he went, along with his staff, in creating this film. They created the rules. They created the playbook that was needed for other people to do feature-length animated films. And those are just some of the reasons this film is so important. I mean, let's be honest. It is American... My mouth tried to move before my brain there. I apologize. This is an American icon. And if you don't believe me, if I say, hi-ho, I guarantee you, you know I'm not saying hi to some hoe on the street. That's crazy. Well, unless I'm in Congress. But that's a different point altogether. I think we can pretty much all agree that if I go, Hi-ho! I'm about to sing a song from Snow White. One of the most well-known songs of all time. You know, hi-ho, hi-ho, it's home from work we go. I can't whistle to save my life, so I'm not even going to attempt to. But bup 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 bup, hi-ho, 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 hi-ho. You know, and other great songs have come from it. You know, whistle while you work. Which, it, you know what? This is probably like the first time I've like sat down and watched it in a long, 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 long time. And quite frankly, it only dawned on me like, wow, this is where Whistle While You Work came from. I always thought Whistle While You Work was just a simple child song. I did not realize it came from this. And if I'm wrong about that, tell me. But I'm getting the sense like, this is where Whistle While You Work came from. And, you know, My Prince Will Come, very soon, Prince song. We're going to get more into it when we get into review, because we're going to break everything down. Today. That's the thing we are going to do today, because we're going to break everything down. We're going to decide what works in this film and if anything doesn't work. And like I said, ultimately we will decide, you know, is this a film that does have an expiration date as far as how good it is, or is it truly timeless? I would like to try to put a definitive answer on that, at least as far as my opinion is concerned. Based off the way I view animated films, which I think is very reasonable. I think anybody who listens to this show has to agree that I have a very reasonable way I view animated films and features and series, and I've been pretty consistent. So we are going to have fun today with this film, because it is a classic, and we're going to give it the respect that it truly deserves. So, again, with that, I think it's time that we get into a review. But that means it's time for a summary. A practice, shall we say. So, Snow White is a lonely princess living with her stepmother, a vain and wicked queen. The queen fears that Snow White's beauty will surpass her own one day, so she forces Snow White to work as a maid, asking every day her magic mirror, who's the fairest one of all? And for a long time, the mirror says you are. Till one day, he says, you are not the fairest. Snow White is. Don't be afraid. So, the queen, in her vain fury, sends a huntsman out with Snow White to kill her in the forest. But finding that he can't, the huntsman tells Snow White to run away and never return. Sorry, I can't do Jeremy Irons. She runs away, though, and she finds a small, quaint cottage that, as it turns out, is occupied by 7 minor dwarves. Will Snow White escape the queen? Find that in on this episode of Tom's Prerogative as we review Snow White and the 7 Dwarves.
Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's home from work we go. Hi-ho, 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 it's home from work we go. Hi-ho, hi-ho. I hope, I hope,
I hope, I hope, I hope, it's home from work.
welcome back, and let's get right into it. Of course, we always start off with music. And of course, that means talking about the score and the actual songs in Snow White. And I mean, hell, let's get over with as far as songs are. And that sounds like I'm thinking, like, oh my god, I have to talk about songs. No. It's like, if I don't talk about songs more than I already have, because I like, talked about it for a little bit there before we started the review, I'm going to go crazy. I love the songs in Snow White because, again, one, the songs do what any great musical does, is in that they tell a particular story. Whether it be giving you a background about who the Seven Dwarves are, whether it be giving you sort of a background on Snow White, her on her dreams, her work ethic. I'm trying to think of what was the... Because there was one more song. I'm trying to... The dwarf song that they sing when they are, like, entertaining Snow White. Oops. I forgot I turned off the internet. I mean, we'll start off with My Prince Will Come, which is sort of the first song that we hear. This is actually, I find it to be a really good song. Again, it's that idea of it's telling the story of her dreams. You know, she's nothing but a lonely maid. And this isn't so much, I think, one evident clue of timelessness is, can the meaning of words or what is being said or what is on film transcend its imagery in a sense of for evolving times? So certainly during the time that this was made, it was certainly to be said that, you know, yeah, girls were expected to dream for a handsome man to marry and to be with. By the way, the song I was thinking of earlier is a dwarf yodel song. Which we'll talk about why that works so well. But I think nowadays one can sit there and watch and listen to those words and understand that the idea of the prince is a metatextual idea for, you know, things getting better. The idea of somebody, whether they be man or woman, coming that may save me from, I don't want to say draw life, but from maybe the pain I'm suffering or the frustration that I'm suffering. She is under the rule of her evil stepmother, who basically hates her because she's more beautiful than her. And so, begging for that person to come and save her is an important thing for Snow White to want to wish for, as far as her characters are concerned, because I also think that the song shows that Snow White isn't as dumb and as stupid as she sometimes is made out to be. Like, we look at Snow White as being a very simple character, but I think that there's some complexity to her. And I think her wishing for somebody to save her is her understanding that there's nothing for me here in this castle, in this kingdom, as long as the evil queen rules. There's an understanding she is a maid only because the evil queen allows it. And as she should fear for the evil queen, as a lot of people do. And so that wishing for that prince to come save the day, again, the prince is the metatextual idea of someone, anyone, man or woman, who will save her from what's going on. So in that instance, that works. The next one is, of course, the prince has his song, When He Meets One Song, which is very sweeping. Again, Harry Stockwell, who plays the prince, doesn't have really a lot to work with. He has the one song, and then he has the part where I don't even think he has any words where he kisses Snow White. But the poor prince. I mean, everybody says, like, the princess is bland. Like, the prince is bland. He really is. There's really nothing to him other than that stuff. That he's handsome and can sing a good song. And it's a good song. It's a song about hope, essentially. And you can see that hope develop in Snow White. The next song, which is Snow White sings, which is A Smile. And a song, which she sings while she's communicating with animals. Which, by the way, for anybody who says Snow White doesn't do anything, I'd like to prove you to prove me wrong, because she basically uses song to gain control and teach animals how to clean. That is some power right there. I dare you to tell me she doesn't do anything. She's controlling animals. That's something in my book. Again, the Whistle While You Work song, Hi Ho for that matter, which, you know, again, like I said, Whistle While You Work on a metatextual level has, again, telling the story of her, of Snow White's own work ethic. Also, the idea of her not believing that one should rely on their beauty, but rather their work ethic, which is, I honestly, that's a timeless feel, because again, that idea that it evolves, that idea that it can, you know, it's a great lesson for any of us to follow these things. We shouldn't judge anybody based on their beauty, whether good or bad, and whether they be male or female, they shouldn't be judged on their beauty, they should be judged upon their work ethic. And I understand why some people may disagree with that, because certainly the problem with that sometimes is a lot of times people are judging their own work ethic on other people who may not have the same type of way of doing things, and that certainly is a problem. But at the same point in time, I think any common sense people have sort of the same idea of, like, are you working hard? Yes, then I'm judging you on your work ethic, you know? Then there's Hi Ho, one of the most famous songs of all time. And on a metatextual, again, it's basically telling you the story of the dwarves. It's telling you what they do every day. Every day, they get up, they go to the mine, they dig, 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 all the way until the bell rings, and it's hi-ho, and off to home we go. And again, telling you the story of the dwarves. The song, like I said, I was forgetting earlier, the Dwarves Yodel song, again, this is more of that comedy point of the movie. And I could see this movie go without the song, but at the same time, it's a fun look into, again, giving each of the dwarves a chance to, and the same can be said for the Dwarves Washing song. It gives you a chance to see sort of, again, each characterization of the dwarf. You know, this one's sleepy, this one's happy, this one's sneezy. And again, playing, using comedy to tell the story of each dwarf. And that's it for the song. The other reason I think the songs work beyond the metatextual level of the stories that they tell is ultimately the melodies. And there's a bit of sort of soft and smooth the jazz definitely in here, that was sort of popular at the time. But at the end of the day, what really works is the sort of very innocent melody and simple melodies that each song has. You know, when you really think about Hi Ho and Whistle While You Work, you know, they have sort of a child's nursery rhyme feel to their melodies. And that works really, really well. And ultimately, that adds to that timelessness of, like, the ease in which you can go into singing it. Trust me, ask any friends. Somebody even says something that says, hi ho. It's like, hi ho, hi ho, hi ho. It's off to work I go. Ba da ba 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 da ba ba ba, hi ho. Literally, nothing will be happening. All of a sudden, I'll just break out going, hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go. Till, you know, I get yelled at and like, stop it! Because I'm Very annoying. But you knew that already, didn't you? So, when you look at the metatextual aspects of the songs, as far as the stories that they individually tell, as far as the metatextual aspect of that they are simple morals and simple things that transcend time, and that the melodies themselves are innocent and simple enough that they can move on from generation to generation to generation and be viable, you know, it adds to the timeless feel of this film. And then there's the overall score, which is very nice. Again, orchestra, very well done. Very much in the American style of sometimes overplaying its hand, being very loud and brash, and definitely it's a character, sometimes a loud character in the scene. But I don't think it's abused, but certainly, like, I think of, like, the scenes, like, when the dwarves are chasing the evil queen, who's turned into the evil witch, and they're chasing her up, and, like, the music is deafening there as, like, it's just building to a crescendo, and it's definitely that American style where it's very front-focused to adding to the drama that is happening on screen. The same could be said for Snow's scene to where she's trying to escape, and she's, like, meeting all the darkness and all these dark imagery and everything, where the trees are trying to grab her and everything. Which seems something like out of the Evil Dead. Let's just be glad there wasn't a rape scene there. Look, I made an Evil Dead reference. I had to make reference to tree rape. I had to. But the point I'm making, as I get off focus, is that the music works very well in, like, very high drama points. The music becomes a character, but at the same point in time, most of the music, it's in the background, and yet it's adding to the character of the movie. So I think that I don't know if it adds to the timelessness of the film, but still, the score is very, very well done for this film. So with that, let's move on to animation. And the first thing that we are going to talk about with animation is the overall style. And I have to say, I really do enjoy this overall style. Again, very early Disney. This very sort of watercolor painted style of Snow White that's very beautiful to look at. Whether it be the castles, the backgrounds, or the sets, or everything. Very, very well done. Like I said, watercolor style. Again, you see, if you understand early Disney and the use of sort of bold line work here, you definitely see that there. You see the very round characters that Disney is known for. And that was something that Disney really used to make himself different from other people at the time, because you look at things like Felix the Cat or the Fleischer Brothers with Popeye and such, and there's a lot of angularness and a lot of angular lines. But one thing that Walt did is he had a lot more rounded edges, a lot more rounded lines that really worked for him and gave it a more sort of soft, I dare say, cuddly feel to it. And particularly with the dwarves and the animals, you see the rounded style. You see it with Snow White with the way, you know, the arm things, the yellow arm things that she's known for and all that. So, again, that rounded line work, rounded edges, bold line work. And then, of course, the soft paint style and the use of that watercolor style. Just... Get there sometimes for some reason when I look at the artwork, there's a magical, timeless feel. And this may be one of those times where I just can't explain it in words. Because I can't. I'm trying to search for the words, but I can't. All I can say is I know what it is. Which it's watercolor. It's got the soft pastel color palette to it that gives it a softness, almost a cuddliness to it. It's very much like a sort of romantic painting. And I guess that painted style gives it that timeless feel. Because I don't know what else would. But all I can say is this watercolor style is what makes this film timeless. At least in my mind. I really enjoy all the character designs. Starting with Snow White. Which, by the way, if you look at the original poster, or at least the poster that I saw on Wikipedia that they had, originally the blue part was supposed to be red. I think it was really much of a great choice to go with blue. I think that the color scheme, blue with the yellow, worked very well with sort of the more pale, almost white skin of Snow White. So, overall, I think it's a great character design. There's an innocence to Snow White that really makes the character work. The Evil Queen is very simple. Great use of green and black color to add to that sort of evilness. Again, they would use sort of this same color scheme in particular when they go back with Maleficent. But you can also see some of this color scheme used in The Evil Stepmother. And so it's a color scheme and there's a simpleness, that tall, long that they keep going back to as far as evil female characters that just works over and over again. And you can see it here with the Evil Queen. And then, of course, her evil hag counterpart also, again, worked really, really well as far as sort of the angle in this. Like, there's still some roundness to her, but they put a little bit more angles into her, and it just gives her this very villainous feel. And again, of course, it also is in particular to the fact of you know who she is. And then you go to the dwarfs. And again, each one's different, each one's unique, and I love, again, it's just to keep it simple. You know, one's sleepy, so he's sort of slouched over in his character design. Happy is all, I don't want to say bloated, but just like a bit more rounded. Bashful, slim, and almost twisted in his... is twisted in his mind, but he tends to sort of twist himself and sort of like a... as if he's trying to, like, twist himself a ball out of his bashfulness. It's sort of the same thing that they would use for, what's the name of the character from Bambi? The skunk. Was it a skunk or something? There's one character that had this long, fluffy tail and... Was it that, or am I thinking of Sword in the Stone and the one character, and Arthur, when he becomes a... I may be thinking of both, actually, but, you know, that's besides the point. But, you know, you get what I mean, sort of that, you know, bashful, you sort of, like, try to curl into yourself. And again, all these little attention to details that really make the characters work and make the characters stand the test of time. So I really enjoy the character designs for that reason. They all make each character work. They each tell a story of each character, whether it be Snow White, one of the dwarves, the Evil Queen, even the prince. His design ultimately tells the story that, like, he's the hero. It's, you know, in fairness, the prince's design is sort of the worst, because, again, the character is plain, but of course, that's also because there's really nothing to the character, because, quite frankly, he doesn't really do much. He's in at the beginning, and he sings one song, leaves, and then doesn't come back for apparently about a year to kiss Snow White and them to ride off into the sunset, and... actually, before I go further, that reminds me, yeah, the red off into the sunset, and of course, as they're looking upon God's kingdom, the Christian ideology, I personally have to laugh at. I mean, I have no problem with it whatsoever. And I do understand that this is America and that there's a lot of Christian ideology. I've never had any problem with Christian ideology. It is. But it's just, it's funny, I guess, for whatever reason, because of what goes on these days. But to go back and look at it and like, wow, they really weren't trying to hide it, were they? It's like, they go off and I'm going to take you back to my kingdom and his kingdom in the sky. You know, again, the sort of in a way, there's sort of a metatextual level to this grim fairy tale being turned into a Christian fairy tale where the prince isn't so much the idea of, oh, I want a man to marry, as in the prince and that hope of a prince is the idea that God will accept me. And there's some very Christian symbiology, which would fit with the Midwest teachings that Disney probably had. Probably back in those days, it was subtle enough. I just think that because of what we know these days and how we understand imagery beat and symbolism, there are sometimes in this movie that there are certain images where the Christian symbology is just like, wow, you weren't trying to hide it, were you? There's the action animation that I want to talk about, which I think is very well done. In particular, that final chase scene is just thrilling. Again, the music helps add to that. But the chase of the drawers, like they're getting closer, and you see the evil queen getting desperate and desperate, and ultimately cause her own death. There's very much of an excitement to that rushing as, you know, they're trying to get her. And then, of course, there's other action scenes. Like I said, really, the two big action sequences are that. And then there's Snow White running from the Huntsman. And again, I've looked it up, and some of the information that I found, it told me that Disney quoted Nosferatu and The Mystery of Dr. Cabaret, which, again, I've seen both films. And so I definitely see the influence of those films in that sequence. I've already probably uncomfortably made reference to Evil Dead. So we'll move on. Of course, apparently I'm turning into some jerk with a camera because I'm forgetting time works differently than apparently I'm thinking it does, and things that come before other things come before other things. So it might be more appropriate to say that Sam Raimi may have been influenced by Snow White and the Seven Dwarves on his tree scene. Though if he was, how did it influence him to do what he did? I'm starting to ask questions that I don't want to know the answers for. I don't know why. So, moving, since there is no other way, by the way, to move on that from that, other than very, very uncomfortably, I'll end with backgrounds and special effects, which, the backgrounds are just gorgeous. They definitely fully immerse you in the locations. But this is also one of our first clues that this is a cartoon and not anime. Ultimately, when you look at each scene, it very much feels like you're looking at a scene that's on a stage. There's very much of a vaudeville feel to each location. As opposed to Sleeping Beauty or other shows where I've said anime, to where, again, you feel so fully immersed, it feels like each location is connected and like you're not on a stage. And again, this is something that separates a cartoon from an anime is, again, it feels like stage. It feels, again, especially since Snow White had a lot of vaudeville influence in the way frames were set up and the way characters were set to act and everything. And so you have a lot of that vaudeville influence. And again, Don't take my word for it. Watch the... In fact, they just re-released the DVD. So go to Walmart, go to your local store, pick up Snow White and Seven Dwarves, and watch the Blu-ray and watch the extras on the Blu-ray to talk about the use of vaudeville and all of that. So, for those reasons, again, you look at the backgrounds. Perfect example. So she comes out, so after running in that dark scene where Snow White is running from the Huntsman, and she lands in the grassy knoll, and she's in the grassy knoll, and she's talking to all of the forest animals. Well, she's in a circle, and yes, they're going in the logs and everything, and that is fully immersive, but at the same point in time, she's not moving from that location. And when she does, it cuts to her going over. Again, the use of very simple camera language here is also another telling sign that this is a cartoon. It's not, like, for instance, having her go from that grassy knoll basically straight to seeing, oh, there's the house in the background, and it cuts to her coming down this hill, and then cuts. But it's not done at any certain time to where you could sit there and say that that sequence of events is a montage. And I know when I say the word montage, everybody immediately starts thinking of the Karate Kid and wants to start singing, "You're the best around." But again, I'm talking about, you know, especially that back in this time, Sergei Einstein's idea of montage, and that there's many different type of montage, tonal, atonal, among others. And nothing in that scene fits the idea of montage. They're just simple cuts, like, here, I showed that she's exiting the forest, showed you what's in the foreground, and then we cut back. And they're very simple cuts. Because a montage is multiple cuts to tell a story. Again, I would say watch Battleship Bookman and watch the Odessa step sequence to understand what I'm meaning for montage. Because that's probably the most famous example of Sergei Einstein's use of montage in that. And again, that's the sequence where they're coming down the steps, and the white soldiers are coming in. By white, I mean the white SARS soldiers are coming down, and they're shooting the people, and it's cutting to people being shot, and a baby carriage coming down, and there are these quick cuts, and it creates this montage that just sort of tells the story of the carnage going on. There's really no storytelling within the camera techniques, and again, that's one of the signs. You know, in Sleeping Beauty, the camera techniques are being used to tell a story along or add verbiage to the story. You don't see any of that here. And I'm bringing that up here with backgrounds because, again, you look at all of the backgrounds, all of them have sort of this vaudeville stage feel. Like, you could build any scene in this movie on stage. You could do this entire movie on stage. At no point do I feel like, wow, this is, I did feel like I was immersed in the world, definitely, but I also, looking at it prospectively, didn't feel like, these are real locations I could go to. Like, I also understood, even though I was immersed, this was still a play. And again, that's one of those telltale signs that this is more of a cartoon than an anime. Again, little things based on my own ideas. And I understand they're my ideas. But I've got a lot of good feedback from people who have more knowledge than me that I may be right. But, you know, again, speculation at this point. So, backgrounds and special effects are ultimately one of the signs that point to this being a cartoon. But that aside, they're very beautiful. It's very well done. The backgrounds are gorgeous and beautiful and just great locations. The special effects, things like rain and shadow and all that, are just so extremely well done, again, to the point to where you hardly even notice it. So ultimately, all of the animation is just amazing. And it's 79 years later, and yet the techniques used are still being used today for a good reason. Because these techniques make these films timeless. And ultimately, animation is the biggest teller of this story being timeless. From that watercolor style that makes it feel magical, to the character designs, to the backgrounds. All of them give this film its timeless feel. Just so well done. So yeah. Animation, well done. With that, it's time for our break. Because when we come back, we're going to dive into the final two parts of Snow White. And definitely put a cap on whether it's timeless or not. Because at this point, animation, music are leading to it being timeless. But we still got acting. And more importantly, we have story. So when we come back, acting and story, right here on Tom's Prerogative.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Yeah, play it. Come on. Play it loud. Play it loud.
And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Illogic. Foolish emotions. A constant irritant.
Intense file out!
Freak! Two! Belong in the circus. Right next to the dog-faced boy.
True!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit.
It's a super prize package worth $9,388.
Money. This isn't the biggest bag over the head punch in the face I ever got. God damn it!
Ow! Go away, Baden.
And now, together by live simulation via the internet, your hosts, Scott Gardner.
He killed a police officer, for Christ's sake!
Thank God damn lucky he didn't kill off.
And Chris Honeywell.
Keep away! Keep away from me!
You are physically repulsive, intellectually retarded, vulgar, insensitive, selfish, stupid. You have no taste, a lousy sense of humor, and you smell.
You're looking at me?
Yeah, because she thought you're some kind of freak. Now, come on,
hey,
let's go.
She likes me, eh?
No way.
Shut up, you freak!
Julius, you...
I say shut up! It's a manhunt! A manhunt!
TwoTrueFreaks.com.
Greetings, podcast listener. Do you like...
Gotcha, Mom!
Or maybe...
Dragon! Slay!
How about...
Tatsuo! Ganino!
Or...
In the year 1999, an abandoned alien battle fortress crash-landed on the planet Earth. Our most brilliant scientists and engineers spent the next 10 years reconstructing the damaged ship and studying its highly advanced space technology called Robotech.
Do you remember...
Our Star Blazers!
Or this?
The year is after Colony 195. As the world constantly changes in the chaotic era, there are two mobile suits that could turn humans into the ultimate weapon. The Wing Zero and the Epion.
Or maybe even this.
After the desire for blood rules all, the only hope left is the one they call D.
Or this.
Gene, grappler ship's dead ahead!
It wouldn't be fun otherwise! Let's do it!
Or...
If Cardis is allowed to be reborn, she'll destroy Marmo as well as Lodos!
Or have you seen the latest episode of...
And just like that, everything changed. At that terrible moment, in our hearts, we knew. Home was a pen. Humanity, cattle.
If you answered yes to any of these questions, then you should check out Anime Freaks, hosted by Dr. Bill Robinson and me, Gene Hendricks. Anime Freaks is a monthly podcast covering all things anime. It is available at twotruefreaks.com and on iTunes under Two True Freaks Presents Anime Freaks.
Hey everyone, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we host a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Presented by the Superman homepage. On the show... Wait.
What?
This just isn't working out for me. It's not bombastic enough. We need something epic.
Like what?
Welcome to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, presented by the Superman homepage. I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am Michael Bailey.
From Crisis to Crisis chronicles the adventures of Superman.
Wait. I'm just not feeling this.
I'm just wondering how there's a needle scratching sound when all of this is clearly digital.
Look, all we need to say is that this is a trailer for a show called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman homepage. My name is Michael Bailey.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And every week we give in-depth synopsis and reviews for just about every Superman book published between Man of Steel number 1 in 1986
and Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. We also talk about the related Superman media, what was happening in the rest of the world when these comics were published, and what else was going on in the DC Universe.
The show drops every Thursday-ish at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com.
From Crisis to Crisis is also a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
So join Jeffrey and I each week as we explore Superman during the post-crisis era, which includes Exile, Panic in the Sky, Doomsday, The Marriage, and beyond.
And write into the show at FromCrisisToCrisis@gmail.com and hear it read on the air, eventually, because we get behind on that sort of thing.
Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Side effects from Crisis to Crisis include loss of money from buying back issues, a desire to read 20-year-old comic books, nausea, drowsiness, pizza, blurred vision, upset stomach, a desire to kick puppies and kittens, and backache from lifting boxes of Superman comics. If the excitement of From Crisis to Crisis lasts more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical attention.
And welcome back, and let's get right back into it with acting, which means it's time to go over our cast list. We have Adriana Casaletti as Snow White, Lucille Laverne as the Evil Queen / Old Witch, Roy Atwell as Doc, Pinto Colvig, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, as Grumpy and Sleepy, Otis Harlan as Happy, Scotty Mathraw as Bashful, Billy Gilbert as Sneezy, Eddie Collins as Dopey. Not that he has really any lines, per se, but did do sound effects for Dopey. Mulrooney Olsen as the Magic Mirror. Stuart Bachman, Bachnan, as Hubert the Huntsman. Or Humbert the Huntsman, excuse me. There's no why there. And Harry Stockwell as the Prince. I guess we'll start off with our female lead. Adriana did a wonderful job as Snow White. And I believe she was under the age of 18. I think I could be wrong. I know that she was like the daughter. I don't know if it was a casting director. I can't remember the little thing I saw that was included with was one of the special features where they go over the voice cast, and She's like the daughter of like the cat, like one of the casting directors, I think, or something. And they were looking for a particular voice, and she sang, and Walt liked it, so she got the lead. I think the best thing she brings is she brings simple innocence, as far as what she brought with the voice. And really, when you talk about Snow White and her voice, that's the thing that keeps popping in my mind: simple innocence. An innocence that, yeah, can lead to maybe stupid decisions, like biting an apple from a stranger, even though she knows she would not. But again, and mind you, again, that goes back to art and sort of the great way they did that scene of, like, she knows something's up, she knows she's shouldn't. But again, that innocence and that belief and that hope ultimately leads her to biting the apple. And that was something that needed to be portrayed in her to make that scene believable, was her voice throughout the series, and, or movie, excuse me. And certainly, that's what happened. Adrienne did bring that simple innocence that made you believe that even though it's obvious that this girl is smart enough to know something's up with this apple, she still innocently believes in that hope and is willing to take a chance in biting the apple. It's also there in the sense of a great contrast to the voice of the Evil Queen, which is much more mature, much older sounding. Lucille Laverne, did a great job as the Evil Queen. And again, it was that contrast of voice where you had the much more mature and that sense of vain. Again, you keep using that word vain in things like vainness and that stuff. But, like, again, that's an overlying theme with this movie, and we'll get more into that in the story. But that vainness that she brought that really added to that evil quality of her. And it provided a great contrast to Adriana in her much more sweet, innocent sound, almost childlike, in fact, very childlike voice that she gave Snow White. And again, it's all to represent innocence as opposed to vainness in their contrasting voices. Acting-wise, they did a great job. They did a great job of making me believe in both characters. I completely bought into every reason Snow White did what she did. As childlike as it sounded, and, you know, that was something I didn't think I would going into this movie, because I did remember the voice. I'm like, wow, I know I haven't seen this in years, but it's like, oh man, am I really going to be able to believe in this princess and believe in this character with such a almost cartoonish, childlike voice? But to credit to Adriana and her acting, she was able to make me believe in the character, because while it's simple and innocent and very childlike, at the same time, it's still mature. And that's really, I think, the secret to what makes Snow White work, is while she does have this childlike voice, this innocent voice, there is a sense of maturity there that you can connect with as an audience member. And that it's a really subtle thing that she's able to do that really makes the character work. With the Evil Queen, again, like I said, the vainness is there. And then, again, it's that disgust for the young, disgust for anybody who might be better than her, that she puts into the character that really makes it work. And then that really comes alive when she turns into the evil old hag. And, apparently it is a true story. Lucille, actually, apparently, was an older woman, had dentures. And so when she was the Evil Queen, she had the dentures in. But when she was the old hag, she actually took her dentures out. And that, like, yeah. Well, you know, at my best I can mimic not having teeth. You talk about really getting into your acting. Thank you, folks. I'll be here all week. Please tip your waitress. Please tip your waitresses. My mouth moves faster than my brain. It does that from time to time. My mouth tries to run away from it. My brain's like, come back, you little mouth. You still need me. As I pull on this imaginary rope. I don't know why. Where was I? Oh, this. That's right. I was on the Evil Queen. But fully engaged in that evil calculus of just not giving a bleep. And I just sounding like pure evil. And not because she was an old lady, but just the way she indulged in her actions and the way almost sometimes even breaking the fourth wall. In fact, I'm pretty sure they did try to break the fourth wall in a couple places there, now that I think about it. But just, it just oozed with evil. And that's, it's another reason why these characters, I think, have lasted the test of time and have become timeless. You know, again, yes, simple and innocent, but there's a maturity there that generation after generation connects with Snow White, along with her actions. Again, we'll get more to that in just a second. Evil Queen, just, again, when you're engaged and you indulge in exactly who the character, it's, I'm taking acting classes this semester, and one thing that my teacher has been pounding into us over and over and over and over and over and over and over again is the truth. You know, the audience will always see the truth, so you can't fake anything. And he's absolutely right. As much as he's pounding it into us, but he's absolutely right. You can't fake the truth. And for a villain, you have to be engaged in who that villain is. It's almost like sort of the classic wrestling idea of, as a villain, you don't rake the eyes because you have to. You rake the eyes because you want to. You know, when you're indulged, you are this evil old hag. You're not bringing this poison apple because you have to. You bring in a poison apple to Snow White because you want to. Because you want to be the fairest in the land. Because, or more importantly, because you hate that she's taken that title so much that you're willingly giving up your beauty that you cherish so much just to trick and get at her and give her this poison apple that you want to give to her because you want to see her die. And that's what Lucille engages in. That want. Not the need, but the want of her character. Indulges in it and engages it for the audience. And then you have the dwarves. And they all do a wonderful job in this movie. They went and got like a lot of vaudeville actors and actors who were known for particular things. For instance, Billy Gilbert was known for his particular sneezes, so they got him. Pinto Cavill, who I believe was working as one of the was an animator working for Disney at the time, and they liked his voice, and they had him be sleepy and grumpy. Roy Atwell was known for like messing up his nouns and things like that, and was really good at that. And the thing about all these voices is that these little things here and there, again, it adds to the story. I understand that they have certain names and you're going to have the characters act as certain names, but they're still telling the story of their names. So you hear, you have Doc, and sort of the joke with that is he should be completely smart sounding and be the most, like, I was about to say able-bodied. That's not the word I'm thinking of. But the best speaker of them as far as being able to correctly form sentences, and yet he constantly mixes up his nouns. And so there's a joke there that always works, no matter what. Especially when it's really acted well, as Ray Atwell does. I think the best was Pinto as Grumpy, quite frankly. I just love that character, very memorable. Really made you believe in all the other characters having fun. He's like, the hell with this. And just that look. That stern, almost Popeye-esque look on it that's constantly on his face. But you certainly believe in his grumpiness the way, really, a lot of what happens is because of his own fears. And so, again, it really adds to the comedy. And that's the thing about each person's voice here is that they each work with each character. Again, the dwarves, as we'll get into, are a lot more of a comedic device, but they are still important to the story. And again, a lot of that comes from these voice actors and their ability to really engage each of these characters, each of these characters' stories, and through their voice, tell those stories to the audience, which is what they do so well with each one of these characters. And for the most part, the rest of the voice cast, as I mentioned, did a pretty good job. I mean, we all remember the voice of the Magic Mirror, and we all try to emulate it. That's how well Maroni Olsen did the voice, and why it's become iconic. Stuart Bachnan, again, I know he would appear in other Disney products as sort of supporting cast, because the voice sounds really familiar. I just can't put it, like, I want to say, if I look back on it, that, like, he was the small fatter king in Sleeping Beauty, because at least that's what he said. That's what I'm thinking. I just don't have the notes in front of me. Like, I number my notes, so, like, I can't, like, remember off the top of my head which one is Sleeping Beauty. So if I could, I'd go back to it. I'd probably see possibly was him, but he did a good job. I feel bad for Harry Stockwell, because I'm sure he's a good actor, but again, we continuously make this joke, you know, the prince really has nothing. You want to talk about, you know, pretty little, you know, shop art, you know, or somebody who's only there to do a deed and a dough. The prince is it. I mean, even talking about the prince makes me tired, as you can see. But overall, I think the voice cast did a really, really good job engaging the characters, making the characters come from a truthful point of view, and really making the audience believe in the characters, and ultimately, again, adding to that timelessness that's Snow White. You know, the acting they were doing is the acting of a certain time, but because they did it so well and it fit the characters and allows the audience to engage it, it becomes timeless. So, lastly, we move on to story. And I mentioned it before, but if there is an overall theme, it's the vainness of beauty. As I call it, or basically the idea that one shouldn't put too much into the idea of someone, whether they be male or female's beauty. They should be measured upon their work ethic, their kindness, how they treat others, etc., etc., etc. One, that is a moral that still works today. And still should be taught today. And I think, quite frankly, we don't teach it enough. And I mind you, when I say don't judge somebody on their beauty, I mean judge regardless. You know, no one should get a job because of they may be more beautiful than anybody else. At the same time, no one should not get a job just because they're more beautiful than anybody else. How a person looks should not be a judge by us about whether they should succeed or not. And ultimately, that is the moral that this story is telling. The queen judges everything by their beauty. And she sees anybody who might be more beautiful than her as a threat, because she values her own beauty as such that she thinks that the only reason she has gotten where she is because of her beauty. Which may be true in her sense. But for Snow White, she doesn't value the beauty. You know, that's why she is a princess that actually does do something. You know, again, those first three princesses get looked down upon as princesses that don't do anything, are just waiting to be saved. And they may be, certainly, in some senses, waiting to be saved, but they certainly don't do anything. Even Aurora, you know, Nox Aurora, we may not see her do anything particular to get to know her, but certainly she has been doing things for over 16, 17 years, as she obviously, well, first of all, she's been able to tame wild forest animals to her will. Again, Snow White's doing this too, so is Cinderella. I don't know about you, that's a pretty substantial thing, because I can't do that. Obviously, she has knowledge of the forest, and what to pick, fruit to pick, and everything. Obviously, she has knowledge, and again, not that a woman should know housework, but regardless of whether you're a male or a female, you know, being able to keep the house clean is an important thing that you do. As far as to the story, it depends on what the character is. In this case, she is on the run from the queen, who means to kill her. Like, she's not more powerful than the queen. I mean, here you have a princess, no power, and an evil queen that knows witchcraft. I'm sorry, if I was Snow White, I'd be running for my life. I don't know about you. I understand that you're going to take your chance. That's great. I'm running for the hills. I'm just saying. And not because she's a witch, but because she has power. And she's more powerful than me. And that's just the way it is. Some people run towards power. Some people run away from it. But again, going back to the theme, because I feel like I'm getting off course here. And going back to the idea that the princess doing something, that idea that she becomes sort of the maternal mother for the dwarves, really, again, tells that idea that she should not be judged for her beauty or really also for her youth. You know, she's very young looking, so the judgment is that she doesn't know anything. And yet, she's able to immediately put the dwarves' house in order. She commands forest animals to help her clean the cottage from an absolute disaster area into a wonderful living space. And as soon as the dwarves come and she meets them, she immediately takes command and gets them to do the one thing that apparently they've never done in their life, which is wash their hands. She arrives, and because of her work ethic, takes control of the situation. Becomes the head of the household. Essentially, Snow White arrives and becomes the leader of the pride. The king. The master of the universe. Any way you want to put it, that's what she becomes. And it's not because she's beautiful, even though people are gushing at her beauty, but her actions tell you otherwise why she's able to take control. Maybe take control is a too strong a word, but again, because of work ethic and because how do I put this? Because I'm thinking about the scene, again, I'm going to the scene to where they first meet and, like, she all like, oh my, the food I'm making is boiling. And she takes it, makes sure it's good, and they're like, oh, we can eat. It's like, oh, have you washed your hands? Yeah, y'all better wash your hands before you come to eat. It's like, that's a very motherly thing to do. And I think some people might see that as like, oh, telling young girls as you should be a mother. I see it more as she has control. Like, if I was a father and I was cooking, I would be telling my children, you just came in from playing outside? Yeah, you better wash your hands before you eat. So, again, taking control, but also being very caring, showing signs of leadership, showing work ethic. Again, even though someone might look at her, see her youth and beauty, and think, oh, she's too innocent and young to really know anything. And yet, she actually knows quite a bit. And again, it all goes back to this overall theme of basically not judging somebody based off their beauty. The overall plot, though, in itself, is kept very simple. And that works for what they're doing. Ultimately, what makes the story timeless is the theme and how they use the theme and how they engage the theme that makes it timeless. But the plot itself is quite simple when you really look at it. Again, really this basic idea. Queen doesn't like Snow White because she fears that she'll be more beautiful than her. One day, the magic mirror says she's more beautiful than her. She sends her out to be killed. But, in essence, her beauty and innocence keeps her from being killed. So she runs far away and never return. That's the second time in this episode Scar has made an appearance. I don't know why. But runs away, finds a cottage, meets up with the dwarves, befriends them, and becomes part of basically their community. Until the witch finds her and tries to kill her, except that the curse that she places on her, ultimately, and placing the curse, puts her in a situation where ultimately she dies, and then the prince comes in to save the day in his one of two scenes. Ultimately, the plot is kept simple. And everything essentially is moving the plot forward, except for once we get to the dwarves. Now, once we get to the dwarves, an important thing needs to happen. And that is that we need to engage in the befriendment of Snow White and the dwarves. And that's basically what takes place. With the yodel song and them singing and dancing and everything. Along with, again, the cooking and the cleaning. All of those scenes are interconnected in, like, meeting the dwarves, gaining their trust, becoming friends, and earning the trust to stay in their cottage. Though all of this seemingly happens in 3 days, which that's the one thing that's sort of hard to believe, but still, it's Disney, it's magic. Again, I'm thinking about the prince, sorry. Get out of my head. You're boring. But still, that plot is used in a very simple sense. And that's all it needed to be. Just buy the books, used very simply. And in that sense, it also becomes a device for the cartoon. Again, remember that this is early cartoon. This is still in the age of the 1930s. You know, one of the things about looking at this movie is that I could see this movie being broken up into 3 to 4 episodes, possibly even 5. There, like, you can see, like, okay, I can see this is where the first episode ends, this is where the second, you know, the first ends with her fighting the cottage, the second ends with the dwarves meeting her, the third ends where the dwarves accept her and everybody goes to sleep, the fourth is the witch, is the queen turning into a witch, and making her way to the cottage, and then the fifth could be, you know, the biting of the poison apple, the final chase, and the prince showing up. Like, you could see, like, these, like, 20-minute episodes just in the way the plot is built. And again, having the thing that ultimately connects it as a movie is the little connector scenes here and there that allow transition into, like, here's this point, into this point, and this point. And so, in that sense, those little transitions of the plot allow it to be used as a device to transform the cartoon in from simple, like, 20-minute episodes, or whatever they may be, into a full feature-length movie. So it's really interesting to see those little subtle elements that are used there within the plot connect the story as a whole, while at the same time remaining simple. The final thing that we'll talk about is the final point that sort of makes it timeless, and that is the Seven Dwarfs themselves. Ultimately, again, like I said, there's that middle part of the movie where really nothing is happening. It's just introducing you to the dwarves and forming their connection with Snow White. And they do this through comedy. And it starts from the moment that they first arrive back at their cottage and realize that somebody's there, all the way through that night till everybody goes to sleep and they leave the next morning. And again, your constant, the use of comedy by the animators through little gags and everything, again, connect you with the dwarves. They connect you with the relationship that's being formed between Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And ultimately, it makes the entire movie work. Because again, you need that connection with the dwarves, with Snow White, to make the movie work. If you don't have that connection, if you don't believe in their befriendment, and then you don't believe in the dwarves allowing her to stay there, you don't believe in their, more importantly, I should say, if you don't have the befriendment, if you don't have the caring between the dwarves and Snow White in the little time that they had to do it, then when the, again, I go back to the fact that, like, Snow White had these animals trained with one song. I'm just saying. But when the forest animals come rushing to the dwarves to, like, let them know, like, the evil queen has come and is going to make her take a bite of the poison apple, you know, you don't have the dwarves understanding what's happened. And they do sort of joke, like, well, what's happened? What's up with these crazy animals? To one, make like, maybe they're here to warn us about Snow White. Snow White? And then, as soon as somebody say, maybe there's something wrong with Snow White, they're all, like, everything's dropped. They jump on the animals, and they're, like, racing to the rescue. And again, it's because they form that relationship between Snow White and themselves. And again, a lot of that came from comedy through the use of gags and sight gags and such. In that middle part of the movie that starts when the dwarves first arrive home and again ends when everybody goes to sleep, that is the that use of comedy forms a connectiveness. And again, this is ultimately what also makes it work as a feature full-length movie as opposed to individual cartoons. Is like the other, like if this was broken up into episodes, there are points that would just be boring. But here's the comedy, and it's put, quite frankly, in the middle, and it forms a connector with the first part of the plot, the second part of the plot, and everything, and it just all brings it together. And it makes you believe in their relationship, a relationship of friendliness. And ultimately, again, also carries that theme of, like, not judging by the beauty, because, again, one might look at the dwarves and, like, oh, God, look how ugly they are. But Snow White doesn't choose to judge them based off their beauty. And like, oh, well, they're dwarves. Oh, you must be nice people. And they get to know each other and they become friends because of that. So again, also engaging in that theme. Ultimately, you know what? Snow White and the Seven Dwarves is timeless. And it's timeless for all the reasons I've said in the past hour, quite frankly. The music, in particular with the songs, have a great childlike innocence to their melodies that makes them timeless. The animation is gorgeous and beautiful. Even today, it's still gorgeous. It's aged a bit, but it's aged like a fine wine, and it still remains timeless. I mean, we're not talking, like, Sleeping Beauty to where, like, the animation looks so good, like, it could have been done today. There's bits that, like, do feel like, you can understand, like, this was back in the early days. But at the same time, there's still a timeless feel to it that, through the animation, through the line work, through the curves and everything that, like, seems Like, if this was done today, it'd be called an artisan animated feature. I guess. You know, anything that's really handcrafted is called artisan these days, you know. But the acting remains timeless. The story remains timeless. Everything about this feature remains timeless. And, yeah, shocking surprise, I couldn't have told you that an hour ago. But I want you to understand how each individual part in this film ultimately makes it timeless, and more importantly, ultimately makes this film a joy to watch. There's a reason it has historical importance. There's a reason it's so influential. There's a reason everybody goes back to this. And that's because at the end of the day, when you look at all these parts and you put them together, you see that Walt Disney, all and you know his animating crew, all by themselves, created the essential playbook of how to do a feature full-length animated film. And it's a playbook that everybody from the guys at Pixar, people like John Clements and Ron Musker, Glenn Keane, people at DreamWorks, and any, Miyazaki, Tetsuo, all of these animators, they follow that playbook that was created with this film. But in regardless of talking about its timing, how timeless it is, or its importance as a sort of a playbook or whatever, the fact still remains, is it good? And the easy question to that is yes. It is good. I had a joy watching this. The gags are funny. Voice acting is really well done. The songs are so memorable. Not just because of how old they are, but for a reason. They get stuck in your head, but a good stuck in your head. End of the day, Snow White's still a really good film. And at the end of the day, isn't that what's more important than anything else? I really enjoyed Snow White, and I think you too will too. That's why I give Snow White and the Seven Dwarves a 5 out of 5. It is a must-have, and an essential for anybody's film catalog. I'm not just talking about people who are animation fans. It's a must-have for any animation fan, regardless of what you're an animated fan for. But more importantly, if you are a fan of film, you need this in your collection. There's a reason it's considered one of the most importance. It's a joy to watch, it's fun to watch, and there's so much history into it. Quite frankly, it's timeless. So, 5 out of 5 from me. And that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I know I did. I know I've been sort of late on these things. So do expect a couple episodes out in a row quickly, as I'm now on spring break and I kind of have the time to do this. So I do apologize for that. But remember, if you have any emails or comments that you want to leave the show, you can send us an email at AppSolutionNetwork132@gmail.com. That's crazy. That's AppSolutionNetwork132@gmail.com. You can also leave us a comment on Stitcher or on our Facebook account that you can find by going to Facebook.com and searching for The App Solution Network. You can also leave us or comment. Yes, you can leave us a comment, that is, on the website itself, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. Make sure you also check out all the other 132 Productions content that, of course, includes CMG's wrestling reviews, Tom's Toonami D&D, the Linter Galactic graphic review, and more from myself. As I'm releasing older episodes of both Hexcast and Tokyo SOS. You had John Ramos and his Sentai videos, and of course Shin Tiger Kuro and his wrestling and anime and video game videos. all right here on the Absolution Network. Of course, on the sidebar, is all our friends like Michael Bailey and Views from the Long Box, Steven Schleicher in the Major Spoilers Podcast, of course, Scott Gardner and the 2-2 Freaks Podcasting Network, along with many other friends of ours. Check their stuff out. They do much better work than me. And that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Next episode, which should be coming out in a few days, we better get our honeypots ready and protected, because there is a cuddly yellow bear out to get some honey. Yes, that's right, folks. We continue Disney Month as we look at the many adventures of Winnie the Pooh. So until next time, my Toonami generation,
find cover. It's gonna get too dangerous.
Stay golden.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.